This is a conversation with Reverend Kelly Smith, Nashville, Tennessee, First Baptist Church. Let's get going now.
You want a blue chip?
Oh, a blue chip, yes, so I can look at the machine. We can just, this works. It's a good, pretty good pickup, so we can just not worry about that too much. I would like to ask you something about your personal history, for one thing, just for the record. I mean, you went to Boston University, didn't you?
No, I did not. I went to Howard University in Washington.
Howard University.
Yes. And I did a little work here at Vanderbilt.
When was that?
That's 1955. Mm-hmm. It was a rather early time in the integration of the university. But, my grade school days were spent in the state of Mississippi. I was born at the all-Negro town of Mound Bayou, Mississippi. Went to college at Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia, and then to these other schools.
How long have you had this pastorate?
Well, I've been here 13 years. 13 years next month, actually.
Do you mind, can you remember at what point and how you became involved in the civil rights effort?
Well, of course, I suppose, in a sense, I could say that growing up in Mississippi automatically involves one in the civil rights effort, one way or the other. You don't ignore it, in other words. But I don't really know when I first began to take, I don't want to really say leadership, but to take a rather aggressive part in some of the efforts being made. I don't know when that started. I remember as a college student in the early 40s being a member of the campus chapter of the NAACP.
This is at Morehouse?
This is at Morehouse, yes. I served a church in Vicksburg, Mississippi from 46 to 1951. And we had a Sunday night radio broadcast and all, and we had occasion to become involved in some things there. I was on the executive committee of that branch of the NAACP. And, at our church, somehow or the other, we developed a kind of image which made people who had some sort of difficulty racially feel that if they come there, they can get some form of help. Well, this kind of involvement sort of characterized my stay there in Mississippi, and then when I came here, I got more involved in it. It's still with the NAACP to start with, and leadership, and then forming another organization, which is an affiliate of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And then things went on from there.
How did the Nashville sit-ins begin?
Yes, this is an interesting. This is an interesting background. It's interesting because I don't think the facts are generally known about Nashville's involvement in the sit-ins in relation to the involvement of other communities. In 1958. When we formed an organization called the Nashville Christian Leadership Council, we had been in existence a very short time before we adopted the methodology of nonviolence. It's 1958. And in March of it, well, the organization was formed in January of 58. In March of 58, we had a workshop on nonviolence that soon. And then we had them off and on for some 16 or 18 months.
Well, these are clinics?
Sort of clinics, that's right. And we had many Sunday night coffee sessions when, and at this time it was all adults. There were no students involved anywhere, and the thought of students hadn't really entered our minds at that time. But at these coffee sessions, we discussed the problems of Nashville and which problems we could perhaps best approach. And having adopted the nonviolent methodology, we had to think in terms of a kind of project which would lend itself to nonviolent demonstrations and which could also serve as an opening wedge for other things. And it was after a good deal of discussions that we, independent of any other community, arrived at the matter of lunch counters. This is an interesting coincidence. We had decided this. And in 1959, we went to some merchants here, some businessmen here, and attempted to negotiate with them on the matter of opening up their lunch counters, desegregating their restrooms, and employing Negroes in white-collar and blue-collar positions. Well, of course, this was considered utterly ridiculous in 1959. In some instances, the people that we went to see felt that, you know, this was just sort of a frivolous thing that you couldn't really be serious about. You must be kidding, you know. After having been told what the policy was and having been told that they would not change in the fall of 59, we staged what we call, well, kind of a pre-sit-in sit-in. It was not really a prolonged sit-in. It was a testing kind of thing where we had gotten the verbal answers from the merchant. We'd gotten the verbal answers that the place was open. We said it was closed to us, but we wanted to find the answer in an action situation, for it is possible, we felt, that people might say that a place is not open where they might, maybe they would serve it, maybe they just don't admit it. I have known of situations like this. So we had a cross section of people, some Negro ministers, some white persons, and some foreign persons, to go down to one of the department stores and attempt to be served. This is in the fall of 1959, and of course they were refused, and had a very interesting discussion with the floor walker there.
How was that? What passed between them?
It was a kind sort of thing, interestingly enough. One thing that that we remember straight through the struggle was that the floor walker said then that if you people wanted to, you can change this policy.
He said this to you all?
He said, yes, he said it to the group. And
were you in that group?
I was not in that group, no. I was not in that particular group. But, and then from there, it became clear what we were going to have to do. So then we sort of intensified our workshop training. And Jim Lawson, I imagine you'll be seeing Jim.
I'm going to see him,
yeah.
Yes, I want to.
Well, Jim was extremely important to us in what happened here, because Jim was really the only person who was not a neophyte in this matter of nonviolence. He lived it and believed it. It was his true philosophy. He had spent some time in India and so forth. So Jim had come to town just a little after we formed the organization and come to live here. So we made him projects director, chairman of the projects committee, and as such, he would, his committee would select the projects and, of course, present them to the group.
Was he at Vanderbilt at that time?
He was at Vanderbilt, yes, he was at Vanderbilt at that time, because I think he was at Vanderbilt from the very, I think that was really his mission in town here. So then the projects committee would conduct workshops. Well, Jim actually conducted them for the committee. And so we intensified, and Jim came to me one time, and I was president of the organization, and asked, what about getting some students to become involved in this? And I told him I thought it would be a very good idea. He said, if you say so, we'll do a little recruiting. And so he did, and got students, and the thing that surprised us, I suppose we shouldn't have been surprised, but we had no precedence upon which to depend, was that the students became very interested and outnumbered the adults quickly and easily. And became part of the workshops and training, and the sit-ins actually became a student affair. There were so many, many students.
Did you meet any resistance on this about recruitment of students?
Not at that point, no.
I mean, not from parents or from authorities of any kind?
Not at this stage.
I see.
Now, later on, we did. Well, once the battle got sort of hot, then there were parents, there were school officials who felt that we were culprits for doing that. But now, we recruited students for workshops. We never recruited anybody for actual participation. These were always volunteers. They had to be volunteers. For one thing, we would not like to have the responsibility of this. For another thing, we believe that the person conducts himself better if it is something that he wants to do rather than something that he's sort of been talked into or almost forced into doing. So for the actual participation, this was purely a voluntary matter, and this was something we had to say over and over and over again, because there were teachers, college teachers, and parents who gave us a pretty bad time because they thought that we were putting the kids out there to get arrested and all. They just didn't know that the kids insisted upon doing this. So this is really the background of this, and of course it was in early February, I believe, of 1960, when we had our first sit-ins, and the first real trouble came the latter part of February of 1960, when we had violence and arrests and everything, and then the whole community sort of found itself involved without really planning it.
But the boycott had begun at what time?
The boycott began, I suppose, about the next month or something. It almost automatically began because with all the difficulties going on downtown, people being arrested and beaten and the hoodlums in the streets and all, people would simply stay away from the stores. And then there were some persons, and we never have found out quite who started it.
They started the boycott?
The boycott, the official boycott. It was kind of a word-of-mouth thing.
I see. Spontaneous to begin with.
It was, yes, it really was. Now, what we tried to do in the National Christian Leadership Council was to give some kind of form and substance to the boycott, and to try to interpret it in the light of our nonviolent discipline. Try to make it make sense in this regard and all, and then to work with it as best we could and with the people who were involved in it, and to get maximum mileage out of it in the pursuit of the goals of desegregation.
How did the crack come?
The actual change?
Mm-hmm.
It was through negotiation.
Now, who negotiated? This is one of the things that come up in different towns, a different method of negotiation.
Yes. We had to learn, because we made some mistakes in everything, but in negotiations we had to learn that there were certain kinds of people who were not available. The National Christian Leadership Council sponsored the negotiations. I, as chairman of the group, was chairman of the negotiations committee for most of the negotiation sessions we had. Well, we had to, frankly, seek out people who were of the right temperament as well as determined spirit and this isn't always easy to find.
You mean for your side?
Yes, for our side. We needed somebody who would not blow his top, so to speak, when something is said that everybody knows, all of us there know, is wrong. You know, get excited. Okay, we don't accept it, but if you become too emotional about it, then we would render ourselves useless in going further into it. So we had to learn that certain people could not be used for this, but could be used in another area. And we finally developed a negotiations team, which worked rather laboriously in this. And this is, I don't want to compare aspects of the struggle, but this is an aspect of it that is much more strenuous and significant than many people seem to think. It's less dramatic But it's a tremendous thing to sit there with a group of people who you've come from two entirely different worlds. You don't speak the same language, and they perhaps have never seen Negroes close up except as janitors and maids, never talked across a table on an equal level. You got to overcome this kind of barrier. So, and then once you overcome that, then they are parts of the economic world. None of us have anything like that, any such experiences. But to sit there and to try to get together on something is a rough experience. But it was through the negotiations, of course, coupled with the openings that came from the demonstrations, that we were able to get a crack in the wall.
Now, in what spirit did the crack come? I mean, was there any recognition of just claim, or was it purely a matter of force across the table from you?
It was not force. I feel, and there are differences of opinion about this, I personally feel that there were people across the negotiations table who were sold on what we were trying to do, on our sincerity. And you see, some of them thought beforehand, I think, that we had horns and that we were all demons who had come down to destroy our way of life or something or other. But when they found out we were real live human beings who wanted the same things that they wanted and had reasons for it and had thought things out and were willing to suffer, sacrifice in order to get this and this kind of thing, I think this helped. And of course, I think some of the things that we said also helped. Now, one of the things we had to learn as negotiators is that you've got to try to, as best you can, sit where the other man sits and try to understand his point of view, even though you don't agree with it. And this is terribly important. So we tried to do this. In our negotiations, we agreed to a control period, what we call a control period, when we were going to desegregate. We understand what your problem is, we said. We know that there are customers, segregationist customers, who would not like this at all and who would like to do you in maybe for it. So let's have a control period where we would start off with one or two Negroes coming to your counter at maybe 3 o'clock or some non-rush hour, people we have designated. There will be detectives in there, plainclothesmen, not uniformed policemen, because that's too much excitement, but plainclothesmen sitting there as regular customers. These people will go in. Your people will be instructed to serve them. Then they would go out, you see, this kind of thing to start with. So we did this for 2 or 3 days. It didn't take long. It didn't take a week, I don't think, really.
The city government cooperated with this program, putting the detectives in, too.
Yes, yes, city government cooperated.
Was the mayor relieved, you think, at this solution?
I think he really was. I think he was relieved because this was quite a problem to the mayor, and there had been some things that we had hoped that he would have done that he didn't see fit to do, some things that he did that did not seem to have been the wisest course to take. And we know that this was pretty upsetting to him and all. I think he was sort of relieved.
How much of the violence, the brutality, was random, and how much was sort of under the aegis of the police force? Or can you distinguish?
It's a little difficult to distinguish because in some instances the police would seem to sort of give license to this other element to participate in violence. This was not a general thing. There were some fine people on the police force, too. But I guess like anything else, you have some of all kinds of people there. And there were some who administered some violence themselves and others who permitted it, you know. And of course, always, if one of our nonviolent demonstrators would be down, would be struck downtown, they would both get arrested. He would get arrested for being struck, and the police always called it fighting. And well, we had many instances where the police claimed that these kids were fighting when we knew better. We knew better.
Were there any convictions of the hoodlums?
No.
No convictions. But the convictions of the Negro who was fighting.
Yes.
Fighting on earlier, the charges, on the conduct.
Yes, in earlier courts we've had it. Of course, we finally would get cleared on appeal. We still have cases hanging. In fact, we have one coming up on the 21st of this month. There were convictions. There were convictions. Until we get it up high enough.
Yes, yes.
Finally.
I was interested in what you said about the attitude of the white negotiators.
Mm-hmm.
And what bearing it might have on a general observation that's been made by a number of people and a number of Negroes. Most recently in print, I guess, by James Baldwin. He says that the Southern mob does not represent the will of the Southern white majority. It's moved in to fill a moral vacuum. Does that make any sense to you?
This could very well be true. There are many non-vocal people who are potentially good people in this thing if they once would become vocal and active. I don't think the mob does represent the Southern white man, not necessarily. It represents him in a sense, though.
Mm.
It represents him in a permissive kind of sense, because he's in charge of the police force and in charge of the cities, this kind of thing. And these people are permitted to exist, and in many cases, what they do is winked at. Well, in that sense, they sort of represent them.
It's the old question of whether fascism represented Italy in 1939.
Yeah, yeah.
I was there for the first year of the war up until evacuated in June 40 when Italy got into war, and I was convinced that the fascism did not represent the will of the Italian people,
mm-hmm.
but it had in the position of authority, it overawed the country.
Yeah, this is what happened.
But now, I find this, on this question, I find all sorts of answers,
mm-hmm.
from those who said it represents the majority all the way,
mm-hmm.
to those who say that it's simply a question of overawing a disorganized majority who has no point of focus.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is said in every tone of voice.
Yeah.
Everything on that spectrum is said.
Yeah.
But I think the attitude held must modify the course of action the person takes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think so.
I mean, a person who says who says, as a very able lawyer who's been deep in the civil rights thing and a very intelligent and conscientious man, said to me the other day, not in Mississippi either, he said, "I'm about to become a black Muslim. It's hard to believe it's anything but white devils."
Mm-hmm.
In answer to this question.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, that's one course of action may stem from this.
Yeah.
Now, he's affiliated with CORE. Well, he's against, you see, he's acting for CORE,
mm-hmm.
but his personal feelings are getting more and more desperately outside of such programs.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, admits this split of feelings.
Yeah, yeah.
And this leads to one kind of action as opposed to what you are saying.
Yeah, I can understand this. I think I have seen some of this develop. I think I've seen some of this develop. Among some of our people here, the feeling that all white people are bad, that there are none upon whom you can really depend and really count. There have been people on our board who have sat this in board meeting. I mean, the NCLC board, National Christian Leadership Council board, we've had this kind of thing done, and we've had I believe we had at least one white person on it since we've been organized.
Mr. Evers yesterday said to me, on this general line of discussion, that one thing he thought was true, that this most of the segregationists, not all, but most of them, would respect courage, somebody stood up and said his piece. And said that the word that he had found, the word of most people would stick once the word was given. Mm-hmm. They could cross a line, and the line, they met it when they crossed it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he's had a very rough time.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Now he has then talked about the other attitude held by other people in the local scene.
Yeah.
So you can, but even he would say that this is a case of some hope of a workable agreement.
Mm-hmm.
That the word would stick. I mean, there's some. Yeah. Well, the Mississippian, a lot of them respect courage anyway. They respect that.
I think there's. I think he's right. I mean, I would sort of go along with it. And I think courage, as expressed in different ways, including nonviolent demonstration,
I think there has been
great respect. Well, we've had some interesting stories to come out of here, to develop here, like the one of the two boys, one white and one Negro. The white boy had attacked a Negro boy, and going back in the paddy wagon, the Negro boy talked with him, and before they got to the jail, the white boy who had attacked him was sobbing, you know, he was crying. He felt guilty and wrong about what he had done. The Negro boy had not shown any bitterness towards him or anything, and that's a little bit too much, you know.
This is the slavery that the man in the mob yearned to be released from, to take the statement of it that's been given by several people.
Yes, I think so. I think it is. He may not be aware of his need.
But he has some inattention about this.
Mm-hmm.
At least he wants to.
Yes, I think so.
If he wants to be justified as right and not just as a piece of defensive violence. Let me ask you another question. As a sort of a leading question to lead where it will. Mm-hmm. I'm worried about my tape. I think I'll change it now.
Okay.
This is the end of tape one. With Reverend Kelly Smith, Nashville. Resume on tape 2.